Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This is season 2, episode 29, where we're talking all about how AI is reshaping the DPO role in 2026. I've been joined once again by Amber Seville. How are we doing, Amber?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It was a really great session. I imagine you agree?
Yeah, it was really good. I think we got a lot of engagement, which was nice. Lots of people joining in with the chat, which was really interesting, actually, to see how it's affecting different people and different organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we spoke about that absolute load of stuff, touched a little bit on the news as always, but I think the real great and beneficial thing in the live sessions is getting that insight from people, as you've said, and getting people coming on and talking to us about what they've experienced. But I don't want to give too much away. We'll let you jump right into the session because we think it's a corker. Enjoy. If you've been listening to Data Protection Made Easy for a while, you'll know that we go deep on the topics that actually matter, whether it's SARs, ROPAs, or international transfers.
And one of the things we hear all the time is, where do I go to learn more? Where is the training that matches this level of detail?
Well, we've got an answer for that. Data Protection People is launching its e-learning platform on Monday, the 13th of July.
And courses were built around the exact topics we cover on this podcast, only in the self-paced format you can work through in your own time.
It's affordable, online, and available from day one. Head to dataprotectionpeople.com/training courses to find out more. Happy Friday, guys. Welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. It's me and Amber once again, becoming a little bit of a frequent thing now. Maybe any potential sort of host on the wings sort of incoming.
I think, yeah, you wish.
Yeah, well, maybe, yeah. More people to do it than me would be nice. But no, I love it here, guys. Don't be daft. But we're doing another topical session today about how AI is reshaping the DPO role in 2026. A couple housekeeping bits. I'll be nice and brief. Privacy notice, we'll be flashing that up in the chat now. Obviously, as you know, these sessions are recorded. If you want to exercise any of your rights, then of course, please feel free to contact us. AI chatbots, will be removing those from the session as and when we go. We've got the lovely folks behind the team just slightly escorting any of those out. And, you know, let's not waste any time. Let's get right into the session. Amber, have you seen anything in the news this week that you would like to discuss?
I think you've caught on to something that I saw as well, which I think is really interesting, which is Meta smart glasses and them being banned essentially over privacy concerns. Because from what I believe, people are obviously like filming stuff on these glasses and then posting it online.
Yeah, well, there's lots of that going around, isn't there? And I think for the past couple of weeks, we've been speaking about the AI glasses and Meta glasses as they begin to kind of adapt and they're looking at new ways of using them. And I've been like riddled with issues. I mean, they had the whole thing with the quality and assurance teams who were seeing like very sort of explicit videos, like when they're going through the quality and training processes, and just generally, you know, people in the space using them and in public areas, and people probably feeling a little bit uncomfortable. But yeah, it's interesting that venues are taking a stance against it. I mean, presumably they're certain venues like concerts. Gig areas, I would think. I don't actually know. Yeah. But I'd imagine it's those kind of venues, wouldn't it? Which I think is a good thing in the main. I mean, you can't fully stop it in the public, but you know, if there are certain areas that maybe we expect to a little bit more private potentially or more intimate than others, organizations and venues in particular having specific rules around it, I'm quite on board with that.
I think it's scary because, I mean, £359, to me, that's quite cheap. It's quite accessible.
That's how much it is.
Yeah.
£360.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't pay for it.
But, you know, I would expect a lot more money for something with those sort of capabilities. And I think it makes it so accessible. And I suppose unless you're aware that this is a thing and what they look like and the different models, you wouldn't. It's quite covert, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, unless you're aware. I mean, how many people are aware of smart glasses? I mean, I guess I could. I don't know. I'd ask my grandma. I don't think my grandma would know. And someone could.
I wouldn't be able to spot them.
I mean, I know they've got like a little light, but it's not the most. I imagine in daylight, it's probably not the most obvious thing. And the point is that they're meant to be discreet. They're designed to be discreet because you know it's like a fashion choice, isn't it? A little bit whilst being a useful well, I say useful, they're somewhat useful.
Also necessity, really, I suppose. If you're looking into like the specificities of it, it's like, what's the necessity to have a device that does this? When you have a phone...
My phone's in my pocket. I mean, I don't take pictures. I'm not the picture type, to be honest with you. I'm not really... I struggle to find a good opportunity to get my phone out, take a picture or a video. And if I do, it always looks slightly rubbish, to be honest with you. So I usually leave that to other people, and I'll usually ask them to send it to me. But I'd never, even if I was, I don't think I'd be thinking, oh yeah, I'll just be using my glasses to take a picture.
I'd forget, to be honest.
Exactly. They'll just be on my face, and I'd be like, and I'll probably look and I go, oh, I can take a picture with these. But yeah, they are. It's not my type of thing, and I'm hoping potentially see more pushback from other venues in a similar vein, especially if they're making people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But Joe, you raise a very interesting point about you've been asked some questions from the workplace, which is very, very interesting. Do you know, you don't have to elaborate if you don't wish to, but are you aware of like kind of the scope in which that they wanted to use it in the workplace? Is it like anything in particular, or is it just like a general sort of approval for its use almost? Again, you don't have to.
I'm happy to, if you're happy for me to speak, I'm happy to share a little bit.
Absolutely.
So the query came in from the operational part of the business, and effectively a colleague rocked up for work one morning in the operation and he's wearing smart glasses.
Okay.
So the reach out from our HR function came to me to say, ooh, like feels a bit dodge. Is this all right? And if you, it's written into policy, you know, it's quite stringent rules, understandably, working in an operational environment and potential dangers for not being able to allow you to use your phone and all that sort of thing. You know, when you made the point about having your phone in your pocket. But we've now got policy dictates what you sort of can and can't do, but it's the policing it that's going to be the challenge of it. And I guess one of the other points that came up, and I know there's no black and white answer to this, by the way, is that there will be, I'm sure, there will be individuals who have reasonable adjustments in place, for example, for a number of different reasons. You know, I believe these things can utilize translation. They can help with partial sightedness. They can do all kinds of things. But how do you police, potentially, a population of colleagues where this is going to start becoming an increasing thing? How do you stop them filming other people, doing it in the loos? I'm not suggesting that people would do this, but for every brilliant new technology that comes out, there is always a stream of nefariousness that goes alongside it, where people will always want to use it for the bad, won't they? So it was quite challenging, and I've not yet been able to give a black and white answer, but it's more we manage this stuff in the same way that we manage any other surveillance technologies in the business. But, you know, how do you, because you can't, police people videoing stuff? Where's it being stored? Are they able to access it on their own personal phones? Is it, you know, is it off in China somewhere on a rogue server? Can it be repurposed for whatever nefarious reasons folk want to? So it's just a really, I don't know, worrying trend, I suppose, is the way I say it, that I'm a bit concerned if we don't get our arms around could cause us real problems. So yeah, sorry if that's a bit long-winded, but
I really appreciate you getting involved, Joe. It's really interesting to hear that insight, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts too, Amber. I guess maybe I'd try to look at it in a similar vein to how we treat it with like third parties that we can't kind of control, you know, customers in some cases, probably more in the main with social housing that we see it, when you got a lot of tenants or other customers recording staff or other people in a way that you don't really want them to. The rules are, of course, a little bit different in respect to them not being your direct employee. But I think it's more about having you already kind of said the sort of organizational measures in place in terms of, you know, your policy that you'll have, that you said is quite stringent, you know, potentially some broader training with the wider teams. And then I feel like it's one of those things that you have to treat as a use case where one of these situations crop up, you're able to you're able to then fall back on what is written in the policies and you know, potentially push that further in terms of, you know, actually like further action on the employee. But you're right, it is a hard thing to police. I completely agree with you. What do you think, Amber?
Yeah, I think I understand sort of the perspective that it might help facilitate people with working, especially if it offers things like translation. I think ultimately, though, there's always an alternative. And I think a lot of the time with data protection, you have to look at sort of the necessity element. So if you can sort of evidence that there are alternative means to assist people that might need some additional support and they don't necessarily need those glasses, then I completely agree that a blanket ban makes sense. I suppose if there's a point where there is a really strong case that they may need this technology, then I suppose you sort of look at providing something like that from the organisation, so you have more sort of control over the data residency and the governance side of things.
That's a good point.
But I appreciate that's not always very cost effective, particularly, you know, £360 glasses. You don't particularly want to be buying
once someone wants one, you know, if someone gets a pair of Meta glasses, even if I don't want one, if I turn up to work on Monday, Amber, and you had a pair of Meta glasses on the business, I'd be asking for one too. So I guess you kind of run the risk of that that sort of trail sort of dropping down. But
yeah,
I think you're absolutely right about sort of ownership and maybe the business tried to take more of an ownership on it in terms of, you know, this is ours, like a work device. We control it's a work device. And it does reinforce that security a little bit more, which I like. Yeah. I think that's a good suggestion. But
it'd be difficult to justify, definitely, anyway.
Yeah.
Ultimately, like you say, policies and procedures in place. But I appreciate you can only then govern staff and contractors rather than sort of
other people.
Yeah.
Anyone that isn't subject to the policy, I suppose.
Terms of use, I suppose, when you look at things like that, terms of service.
But Lawrence is absolutely right. Yeah. You know, it's similar to other things that are bad, but you can't control. You know, you can't control conduct in the office or people stealing. But what you can control is the actions that you then have to follow up with to try and mitigate that, basically, as and when they happen.
And having it written down so it's enforceable, especially like if you have a bring your own device policy, then having it in there. That's the way you can go with it, really.
Yeah, no, absolutely on board with that. It's very interesting, Joe. I'd be keen to see if you've got any updates in the coming weeks, if anything moves with that, or what your stance ends up being, potentially. But thank you so much for sharing. We really appreciate that. I'll do one quick piece of news, and then we'll jump into the session. But effectively, it was off the back of a survey done by the ICO that publishes its findings of basically examining public attitudes towards information rights and data protection. It showed that awareness on information rights basically is increasing, and it's gone up from the percentages last time they did the survey, which seems apparent from what we're seeing in the field, especially on probably more so on your end than on my end, Amber, with your sort of interactions with your customers. But it definitely feels like individuals and members of the public are much more acutely aware of what some of their rights are, you know, possibly through the lens of things like AI, probably more likely so. But there is, you know, social media being such a prevalent thing to talk about these things. I know that Alex, one of our account managers, has mentioned that there is some sort of TikTok accounts that do talk about these kind of stuff sometimes. So seeing that's increasing, that seems like an obvious thing. But apparently public confidence in how organizations store and use personal data has weakened. I wonder if that's an effect of recent news, probably. If that's likely to add an effect on it with the stuff that we've had from, you know, with the sort of AI agents that have gone a bit rogue recently, cases with like the Ministry of Defence, obviously being quite a big one, probably for public trust, and I wonder if that has a big sort of impact, and I imagine those are probably the leading factors. I don't know if you have any thought on, but I mean, I have some thoughts on the elements with the knowing how their personal data is used. I think that's maybe from a lack of them either not knowing what the privacy notice exists to do, or them also not having much of a desire to read it, to be honest with you. I think it's probably more so that last point.
Yeah, I think it's, like you say, it's really good because it raises so much awareness. But then on the back end of that, like what Shahar's mentioned, we are seeing such an increase in those rights being exercised, which where those rights are being exercised sort of genuinely, that's great that people are aware of how they can, for example, submit a subject access request or request that something is deleted. Because I think it sort of promotes accountability across the board, but then where it's maybe being used less genuinely and it's being used sort of more maliciously for sort of like manifestly unfounded, I think then obviously there's a massive issue because people are almost just submitting SARs because they know they can, they know it will disrupt the business.
And this is relevant, I guess, to the topic at hand in terms of how AI is shaping the role for DPOs. As a DPO yourself, do you feel that it is having an impact on the amount of questions that you deal with that are SARs or SAR related, especially from comms that you know that are fairly obviously created from AI?
100%, yeah. And I think it also fuels a lot of misunderstanding because I suppose a lot of people are probably using the free versions or, you know, they're just relying on AI to almost develop this subject access request. So a lot of the times it's you see a request and most of it doesn't even fall under the scope of what a SAR generally covers. But yeah, I think then it confuses people sort of within the business because they're confused about what they should be supplying, especially when these are so, the prompts, I suppose, are so well thought out and they look almost very formal.
They're very well written, and it could very likely, you know, confuse or stress out, you know, some poll worker who's received it who might not know much about data protection.
So generally, I think it is confusing people.
I can tell you from my end, because I did run some analytics actually on the support desk quite recently. And our cases that we get in respect to SARs are significantly higher this year than they were last year, and our like by far our greatest sort of case volume. And I had a look at some of them, and it's all about we've had this request. It's very vague. They're being quite difficult. They're pushing back. A lot of it's about complaints and re-reviews and stuff. And 9 times out of 10, it's stuff like the customer is asking that we have this period of time window to review the complaint or re-review the SAR based on the complaint. I'm like, oh, okay. 14 days usually they pull out sometimes.
Seven. Yeah, seven.
I've noticed
that. I don't know where it comes from.
Yeah, we'll re-review this SAR in a week. I guess it's the, I don't know, they're pulling it from somewhere, aren't they? But it's just...
I think from the ICO guidance, not obviously in relation to SARs, but I think the ICO generally says they'll take 7 or 14 days to get back to you on a matter. So I think it's almost pulled that from somewhere within the ICO's website.
And we've seen how much it is. You can even see from the chart, you know, 80%, 50%, 50% again. There's so many different people saying that we've almost, you know, in some cases almost seen double the SARs that you've seen last year. The resource on data protection teams this year more than anything have felt so significant in respect to individuals' information rights. And you know, it's struggling. And it's always hard to suggest sort of what we do going forward to kind of help sort of build that resilience. And I guess it is hard because a lot of these requests require time to go back and to correspond and to talk with them and to work them through and to clarify the scope, probably extend in some cases. They're probably going to want you to re-review them. And I think the whole SAR process in general has become much longer than it used to be. Because I think the more standard approach now is to directly push back and to always ask for a re-review. And it is really complicated matters, I think. And
Especially with Dua, referring to what Charles mentioned about complaints. Now that Dua pushes you to complain directly to the controller before approaching the ICO, we're also seeing a massive rise in data protection complaints because immediately, you know, you sort of note that they have the right to complain to you directly and they go, okay, fine, I want to submit a complaint almost immediately wherever there's some sort of backlash over SAR. And I think, again, there's more pushback, like you say, on SARs because you'll complete a SAR, they'll probably run it through AI again and they'll be like, oh, you know, I didn't get what I wanted, so I'm going to argue with you more with more AI generated
responses. Are so terrible, but I can, it must be really time consuming for a DPO. Joanna, you make a point and I'm intrigued. What are these? Well, I've never heard of these services before. Personal data removal services. Are you saying these are companies who will, who kind of jump in on behalf of people and will send out SARs two organizations that hold their data. I'm very shocked. I've never heard of that before. But maybe that's just my ignorance. I don't know. That's really intriguing. I don't know if you want to expand on that, but I might have to take a little look into that in the future, I think.
Yeah, I'm happy to share a little bit. So we seem to have like a bulk increase of a load of opt-outs that came in, and they all had exactly the same request of opting out. So very small and word for word. So I did a little bit of research into it. And there are these companies, like I mentioned in the chat, where you can pay and they'll do like a bulk request out. So I found that with the requests that we had no record of these individuals that were requested data. So it makes you wonder where they come from. So depending on where we are, obviously we are based in the UK. Some businesses are sort of international. And if you've seen the recent updates, there's a specific laws in place in Canada, beg your pardon, California. So they, by law, they can use this registered service and do sort of these bulk deletions. So as we tend to follow sort of US trends, like the Sumi culture and things like that, I can no doubt anticipate. So where we've got the likes of AI being able to use to make SARS difficult for us, you've got that kind of thing. Is that a precedent that is being set? Are we likely to get more of these if, you know, someone's got a grind pick that they can use these services?
Sure.
I don't know how much they cost. I'd be quite interested if you did do some digging, is to how well, you know, can you put in your details and just it bulk sends it to like 100 companies just at the click of a button? I don't know, but it's a trend that seems to be happening maybe in the US.
Very intriguing, Joanna. Thank you so much for sharing. I am making a note of that as you speak. Imagine me typing. I definitely am going to look into that, and I'm going to come back next week and let you know what my thoughts are. I feel like there's so much against organisations now that make it really hard to sort of, you know, push back. And I don't want to dwell too much on this AI stuff just with SARS, because I appreciate we talk about SARS a lot. And I know that people like to talk about SARS, but obviously we'll dwell on some other elements of it as well. I suppose before we move on, if there's any sort of like, if you do feel like you are struggling resource-wise, in terms of even if you just need some help with responding to some reviews for SARS, you want an extra pair of hands or eyes, if you do have a contract with us or you'd like one, feel free to reach out either to one of our account managers that you have or you know, any of our two lovely folks here. If you do have any questions like that, obviously we're always more than happy to help, and we appreciate the strain is significant. But let's try and talk about AI in a more positive way if we can. Amber, do you think there is ways right now that AI is positively shaping and informing the role of a data protection officer?
I think it's forcing us to sort of look outside the box a bit, particularly because we have the EU AI Act as a comparison and the things that are developing across the EU. I think as a consultant, it's given me new things to look into, new things to learn about. I guess it's a similar, it's a news case as well, but something I saw this week was that the FPF, or the Future of Privacy Forms, have essentially developed a framework for assessing the risk of AI systems.
Okay.
Which I think is something that is quite positive, or it's very positive. It's something that I've actually been working on a bit internally to create a document that's similar, because I know I mentioned sort of last week that I don't feel like DPIAs really do the job, especially if you're not well acquainted with AI.
Sure. Yeah.
So having something like that in place is really, it's really good. I think it really sort of facilitates the innovation and development of AI, whilst also realistically looking at the risks, looking at sort of data residency and training materials and so on, the degree of autonomy, all the things that might make AI risks more significant. I think, yeah, maybe that's positive for me anyway. I find these things interesting.
No. I guess for you particularly, you spend quite a lot of time sort of working and sort of piecing together some of the AI governance stuff, and you've been working on a bunch of stuff with it. So I suppose for you professionally, I guess you feel that that's enhancing your skills, your knowledge, maybe your understanding of risk. It's even furthering that potentially. Which is great. I mean, I guess any sort of professional development is always sort of welcomed, isn't it? I guess DPOs are getting no choice but to have to adapt to that. And if it's a benefit to them professionally, then great. It's always a great thing.
I think it makes it accessible for organisations as well, or at least that's what I'm intending to do. Mm. I suppose looking at these frameworks, often they are tailored to sort of DPOs or the data protection lead. So I think, for me, trying to come up with some sort of risk framework that can be implemented internally that doesn't require any sort of expert knowledge on AI or any sort of significant knowledge, I think that's really important, so that it's accessible.
Yeah. No, I really get that. And I kind of resonate with that. I think, to me, I looked at this as a certain kind of way. I was kind of thinking, a DPO obviously has certain kind of tasks they have to do. Obviously, I don't really act much as a consultant or a DPO these days, but when I did, I was thinking, what are some of the things I see? What are some of the things I do and did? And do I think that AI could currently sort of supplement that? I've just got a few bullet points. I guess I'm going to kind of tick through them, and we'll have a little chat if we think that AI has positively increased that, or it may provide a not as helpful as we'd like, and maybe scope for improvement in what we do. So the first one is sort of general advice and support on data protection law. I mean, I don't know how you feel, Amber, but my limited interactions with ever seeing people use AI for advice, or people getting advice on data protection law from AI, has been particularly shaky, to say the least.
Yeah, definitely. I think I sort of say this quite a lot, but you need to have the base knowledge in order to be able to use these systems. Mm. You need to obviously be putting in sophisticated prompts, know the basics. So for me, obviously, and you as well, I suppose, we've both had quite a lot of training in data protection and experience. So when we see, for example, a response come back from an AI system and it says this legislation or whatever, we know immediately that it's incorrect because we know what's behind it. But I suppose if you're not fortunate enough to have much data protection training and you're just using it to quickly, I don't know, draft a privacy notice, you're probably not going to catch if the date's wrong, or if it's referencing the wrong legislation, or if it's not comprehensive. So I think it's great for a starting point sometimes, and it's great to bulk out your knowledge if you already have that pre-existing knowledge.
Yeah.
But also linking it to another one of your points is also training as well, because I suppose they fall hand in hand.
Yeah, in terms of sort of being able to sort of educate yourself the further with the AI. I mean, I think I put training for a reason. And I think the reason was kind of mainly in respect to, like, I think it helps in some of the admin burdens with creating training, not in creating the whole of the training, because I think that's, again, probably not going to produce very good training. But when we do speak about training, and we have had a couple of sessions on it, I think the value is with the trainer a lot of the time. So if the trainer can make something good, and they don't want to spend, and they might not have the resource internally to have someone else spend loads of time sort of helping create that, I do think AI comes a long way in potentially helping fulfill that. You know, if you have to deliver your own training internally, it might help with alleviating some of those burdens. Obviously, I think the key point is, as long as the content remains your own and you're not, you know, and I could see that being helpful. But again, is that like an admin thing? I think AI has proved for an admin task, it's pretty good.
Systematic, I think it's pretty good. It's just when it needs sort of more. I suppose it depends what model you pay for, but from all that I've seen, they are generally not very reliable.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if anybody's ever sort of utilized AI for like any actual like advice to say, we've had this situation, what do you think? And if the output proved to be helpful or not. I mean, it's always good if you kind of know the answer already, or you're close to knowing the answer, and you just maybe need, sometimes it's good to hear back another line of thinking to almost kind of reinforce your point, or to make you feel comfortable. So if you kind of already know where you're getting at, it might go far enough away to just kind of rebuild that confidence.
Yeah.
What do you think about AI for things like ROPAs? Do you think that can prove Oh, Lawrence, I see your hand up actually. Before I ask, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, sorry. Just wanted to jump in on that point about using AI for advice as a DPO. One of the dangers with AI is always that it will sort of get into tend to confirmation bias. So you start talking to it and it starts to agree with you, saying, yeah, exactly. I agree. Yeah. You should redact that. And then you have to make sure that you always ask it, what's missing here? What's the weakness in your response? Because I asked Copilot this and it said, we will give you a response. It said, I'll give you a response that's the best available at the time. You need to ask me for the weaknesses, unless your prompt is designed to remove weakness and say, what are the weaknesses, or make this regulator safe. So it compares it against ICO cases and other things. Mm. So I'm not to show my age, but I've got 25 years in this field. So I know a heck of a lot about data protection and FOI, having done both over the last 25 years. So when the AI comes back with something that doesn't sound right, I have a quick intuitive understanding, does this sound right? So I can imagine somebody who's new to the field is going to be like, oh, that sounds good. Yeah. AI saying it, they've done all the work. Great, grab that. So I think it's not necessarily a generational issue, but it's also like a pre-AI knowledge versus a post-AI knowledge. And how do you sense check that?
I really agree with that, Lawrence. I think that's a really interesting point. And you're so right with the with that kind of confirmation element. I believe it leans and teeters towards the answer it thinks that he wants to hear. But I think that's such a great point. And I think you raise a great point potentially about the new generation of professionals in being in this post-AI world as opposed to the pre. I mean, I guess when I first started at DPP, it was kind of just before... It really had a big kind of like surge, but it was always half there. I think it's hard to, I say it's hard to remember. It was 4 years ago, but it does feel hard to remember. I never remember it being remotely prevalent to when I started the role. And now everything seems to be tailored around AI in some kind of way. A lot of people that you speak to are using AI for stuff. Lawrence, I'm the exact same way. I think I hit my head too many times as a kid, to be honest with you. My memory's not really good. But I do think it's definitely something we do see more so. I mean, you've had a fairly experienced time and field in DP as well, aren't you, Amber? I mean, have you seen that kind of shift, that kind of almost pre and post kind of AI thing as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think even just being sort of at uni, obviously sort of studying law at uni, it was very similar. And I think you can just tell that obviously data protection is just so nuanced. And I think that's where AI generally struggles, because it can recite back to you what the legislation is and what the facts are, but it's never that black and white. With law in general, let alone data protection. But obviously it's always case by case, and nuances are really important. And as a DPO, everyone will know the common answer is it depends. And I don't think the AI has a functionality to sort of provide that it depends nuance.
Yeah, it doesn't have that distinction, does it, of being able to say, well, it could work in this circumstance, but there's also got this case. Like something, a lot of things with data protection can work in practice most of the time, but it's always around the context behind it, and it doesn't always have the ability to be able to decipher that with like good confidence, I don't think. But no. I think if you can able to word it in the way that Lawrence was kind of suggesting, it does seem that there could be some value there. And I think the question I was going to ask as well is, do you think AI could or very well could be useful for things like ROPAs, DPIAs, LIAs, you know, those kind of tasks? Do you think there is potential for AI to be a positive in that regard?
I think for ROPAs specifically, I think that AI can be a very useful tool for pre-population, especially if you have sort of the general structure of the business and generally what they do and who they share data with. But obviously there's a limit as to what you can provide the model with in terms of confidentiality and not oversharing any information. But I do think it is a really good tool to sort of assist you with those things. Same with DPIAs and LIAs. Generally, DPIAs can be quite sensitive because they're high risk.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I guess you're working maybe in an idealistic world where you can find a AI system specific that can integrate with everything you have, and it can kind of like pull stuff from everywhere. And yeah. But you, as you say, when you're doing stuff like deep AI, you're on the risk of more sensitive things being playing involved. Yeah. But I mean, I do see the potential for it. I did see someone who was a customer of mine, and they said that they use they act as a processor in the main, and they say that when they get due diligence questionnaires, they use AI to source a lot of the information that they have to help answer some of the questions. And I'm like, I can see the inherent benefit there.
And the inherent risk.
Always
correct, I suppose.
Then. Oh, well, you know that they're checking it.
Yeah.
Hope you're checking
it. It's that element of human oversight, isn't it? Same as in anything that's automated. Because I do think AI is so great for assisting, and I don't see any reason why we should sort of be a blocker to that. But I've had clients sort of hand me back DPIAs, and immediately I know it's AI developed, and it's not inherently wrong, because I appreciate, you know, sometimes we're time constrained and sometimes we don't have that sort of base knowledge, and they're trying to do their best and not, you know, have to pay for external resources, which is completely understandable. But I think sometimes you just need a human to overlook it and make sure.
Experts are always required, aren't they? And I mean, that's hopefully not me and you trying to validate our position in the world. But especially with stuff like AI, I think the ultimate round off thought is that it is a fantastic tool that will hopefully be able to help in the role as a DPO. But what matters is that you can supplement it with your pre-existing knowledge. You know, I think potentially there's a risk of newer individuals into the role having an over-reliance on it, which may mean that a lot of their expertise and knowledge are being founded on that basis. But if you can build a really strong foundation through your pre-existing knowledge, and you already have that, again, if you feel that, you know, competently speaking, that you know loads about data protection, there are some things that trip you up, but in the main you can handle most things, and you know most areas of the law, you could probably use AI in really quite an efficient way for some of the things you do. Again, it's about the value of the person but behind the AI at the end of the day, and what they can continue to add to that. And I think, you know,
and that's what I mean, really, the human element needs to be someone overlooking it who actually knows what they're talking about.
Exactly. Well, that's what the law says as well, in terms of stuff we can do to be able to even allow to be able to do these things. We need meaningful human intervention.
Yeah.
And I think part of that meaningfulness is also the competency of the individual being able to handle whatever the thing is that's being churned back. I guess that is part of what the meaningful thing is. That's kind of how I've chosen to interpret it anyway. But it is interesting. And, you know, you'd be people like to moan about it, but you'd be kidding yourself if you say that you haven't used it. It is the way that the world is going. And we must, you know, we are meant to be innovative, I guess, in that regard. And we're meant to be able to, especially as a DPO, I guess, where we're meant to be able to sort of push the boundaries of what is reasonable and open ourselves up to innovation, which the ICO is obviously so clearly wanting to do, but still maintain that privacy by design default, still maintain that risk appetite. And, you know, we are the great and fortunate people who get to deal with that kind of stuff. And I must admit, the role of a DPO has become ever more interesting, I feel. As much as I'm sure that it's another pile to be added for you guys, and I'm sure it's probably coming with all of its own other complications. But I do feel that, you know, we're moving in a way that the role is becoming more interesting, more nuanced, and you know, I'm excited to see how it develops. But I also love and appreciate the caution that the sector bring around these kind of things.
And I just want to touch on something that Martin asked, actually, about whether it's better to have an AI-generated policy in place, was it, or to have nothing at all. I think in that regard, I think it depends, honestly, and I hate saying that. I know it's such a typical answer, but if you have a policy in place and it doesn't really align with your business, it's not workable, people aren't following it, then there's ultimately not really anything there in place anyway. So if you've just drafted something with AI just to say, to almost tick a box, to me, I would argue that's pointless. Whereas I'd much prefer an organization to come to me and say, this is the process we have in place, but we've not written it down yet, because at least you have tested that process actually works. But ultimately, I suppose if it aligns with what you're already doing and it is being followed, then I don't see an awful amount of issue as long as it's largely compliant, but I would still obviously recommend having someone look over it.
Yeah, we're skeptics intentionally, as part of the role to be a little skeptical and to be a little concerned. I mean, I can see from the poll, the Mars has put a poll in because he's busy behind the camera, this boy. Let's have a look.
Engagement.
Two people want to burn it to the ground. I didn't realise I already clicked vote. Must be someone action on my behalf. I can't see who's put anything on what anyway. But if you put burn it to the ground, fair enough. concern, but adapting seems to be the point on the charge, which I think is probably where we. Where we I'd probably say we both sit, unless you disagree, Amber, unless you maybe feel like sit somewhere else.
I don't know. I think I'm teetering between them, perhaps cautiously optimistic, but I think it depends. I think I'm at that point now where a few months ago I said, yeah, burn it to the ground. And now I'm sort of riding the wave because I'm like, we don't have a choice.
Gotta move with it. I mean, who are we to say otherwise, really? And you can see that the ICO and the government will keep running forward with this as fast as they can. I already know what Miles would answer to this question anyway. So I think that's why he's put the poll up, maybe to validate himself slightly.
Honestly though, ChatGPT writes you great recipes. I'd really recommend it.
Oh, really? That's
really okay. Good. So, yeah.
Fine.
Everyone compliments my work dinners and I give all my credits to ChatGPT. Ooh,
didn't even think about that. Used to use it for workouts if I felt uninspired. But didn't really use it for much else. Like personally, do I use it for anything personally? I don't know.
No comment.
No, really?
No.
Are you building up a personal relationship with OpenAI? Some people do.
You mean Claude? He's got a name.
My apologies. No. What have I ever used it for anything personal? I must have done.
You definitely have. You just want to tell anyone done. You've been
no,
doing selfies and
yeah. Give me abs. Give me abs to post on Instagram, please. I think it's one of those things. I think hopefully we're all, you know, we've got a lovely community here that all seem probably equally a similar way to AI. And I think if, you know, we all band together and we work as a community, I think that's the great part about it, is we have such a good space to all be able to kind of align our thinking and, you know, places for people to agree and disagree and for people to sort of get together and land ourselves in a good position collectively. And obviously it leads us to the stuff with all the community stuff that we want to do, all the events we do. Obviously this fantastic podcast is a privilege to be able to do to you guys, of course. So, you know, it's all about us coming together. And as much as I moan how much we talk about AI, it's such a fascinating topic. So and I'm very, very grateful for you all to join us this week. Next week it'll be another GDPR radio session. I believe Kate may be back. So if anyone's been missing Kate, I think she'll be making her her return next week. Whether that's in place of me or Amber, who knows? Amber is potentially a mainstay. She might be looking to put me on the bench.
About time.
Probably for the best. Probably for the best, to be honest with you. I don't. Maybe that is welcome. Maybe put a poll in for that, Miles. If time to bench, Kate. And if, you know, don't hurt my feelings, but you can vote honestly. But, you know, on that note, we'll let you all jump off. We hope you have a lovely rest of your afternoon. I hope you don't get a breach that drops in at 4 o'clock like me last week. And we hope you all have a lovely weekend, and we look forward to seeing you next week. Sorry.